continuing with the Douglas First to Know, I want Lucy's name.
Lucy Ann First to Know, now Lucy Clivey, C-L-I-V-Y.
C-L-I-B-Y,
Clivey.
Okay. And her husband is?
Is Paul.
Paul, and her son is?
Cole, C-O-L-E. Cole Winston, named after me, she said. not the Cole, but the Winston. My middle name.
Oh, is that's right.
Douglas Winston, so right. She okay. Called it.
Well, that makes
she picked. She made up the name Cole from somewhere. And
it's a nice name.
And Cole Winston.
Okay.
And Lucy has a degree in nursing from Fresno State, and our second daughter Sarah, who has a BA degree in landscape architecture from Cal.
And is that with an H or not?
Yeah, she's got the old-fashioned Sarah.
Okay.
Sarah Jane?
Sarah Jane.
And then she went to the University of Oregon to do a master's in landscape architecture. And she got, she was there 5 years with me paying for it. And she got... The program never did finish, but she got a Bachelor of Landscape Architecture. Something wrong with the program and the faculty. I was actually going to write the president and say, hey, these people are not doing it right. Because Sarah said very few ever completed due to the faculty. She was doing a thesis and one member would say, you do this and go to the next member. No, you don't do that, you do this. And it ended up she never did finish it. And so she ended up, she went down one summer to Long Beach where she'd gone 1 year to Santa Cruz and her freshman roommate had gotten a master's in some kind of writing at USC and she was getting her to help her. And so she took a part-time job with in the accounting of Pioneer Entertainment and Japanese company, and she found all sorts of errors that the accountants were making. They were on vacation, and so her boss said, I want to hire a new accountant, and I want, you know, the ad says 2 years experience, but I want you to apply. Well, she got the job, so here's somebody with no business background, landscape architect. She still loves plants in a big way, and so after a while, I know she had an MBA working for her, and she was a little upset that he was making more money than she was making at the time. I suppose that was standard, and anyway, she became manager moved on up in the system, became manager, I think, of Karaoke. Karaoke is that Japanese singing to records, and she would select the song. She's not a musician. She'd write the contracts, you know, necessary for these. And negotiate contracts, things like that. And then I think she became manager of budgeting. And now she's post-production manager for DVD discs music for them. And for somebody with, she's very bright, works hard. I mean, she really... Mm-hmm. Is dedicated, and she's taken, I think she said, 8 extension courses on entertainment economics, stuff like that, at UCLA. So, you know, at night she's done that through the years, so that she obviously knows her field.
She knows what she's like.
To come back to the Bay Area, but she's kind of into kind of a field that. The main part's down in Los Angeles,
sure,
in the entertainment.
But
right.
And interesting.
And very bright girl, and but you know, somebody turned her off in about the fourth grade on math, and you know, she had no use for it. And to me, it's interesting how this accounting part that you know she took hold of without any background in it. Our son, who's the youngest, Stephen Douglas, S-T-E-V-H-E-N. He's old-fashioned Steve.
D-H.
D-H? No, P-H.
No, P-H.
Oh, yeah, excuse me. I said P-H. I'll be old-fashioned.
Stephen.
Douglas.
Douglas.
Our first daughter, we had Linda Margaret, and we picked two names, Linda Margaret, Stephen Douglas. So Steve was named...
A long time.
He was named when he was the fourth. His name was already there, and so Steve, I just got interested in engineering, and I suggested to him that if he took chemical engineering, might be the broadest thing, and he did this, majored in chem down at UC San Diego, and he took a lot of German in high school, and we, as I told you, spent a sabbatical in Germany, and he told me as a freshman he signed up to take German 2, and I said, hey, you're nuts. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, he should take German 1. Well, he got an A out of German 2 as a freshman. So in the end, he had a minor in German literature as a chemical engineer. And he spent his third year abroad at Göttingen, which is a UC campus abroad for Germany, and obviously became completely fluent in German. So when he graduated, somebody gave a seminar from Yale, when he was a senior, and Steve asked a lot of questions. This person was talking about particles, and of course Steve knew about particles from me and from his experiences in Germany, so the person asked some assistant professor that Steve was working for part-time who this young guy was, and so he went and talked to him and said, do you have a job? And Steve said, well, no, I haven't even started. He was a senior. He hadn't even started to think about it. And said, well, why don't you come back and work for me for a while in the summer? And so Steve went back and Yale worked for him as an employee, as a lab assistant. Mm-hmm. He told me he was auditing all, you know, a couple of the graduate chemical engineering courses and doing the homework, and he said he was even writing the midterms exams, and he said he was doing okay, and I said, well, hey, well, there's your meal ticket. And so that fall, with not a very good GPA that he had, because he didn't study very hard, San Diego, he was admitted, you know, to the Yale PhD program with full fellowship, but he did it by the route I said. So he eventually got a PhD in mechanical engineering and chemical engineering. It's fairly small in the engineering there. So working on with a very senior, elderly, retired professor, well, was the real advisor, not the nominal one, named John Fenn, who, F-E-N-N, who had developed a field called electrospray, where you spray a solution into a flame, and you have a, or you just spray it, but you apply a very high potential, so 5,000 volts, so you charge the little droplets as they spray. And then, let's say if you've got something dissolved in the solution and it evaporates, now those charges are left on, say, the little crystals that might form. Mm-hmm. So Steve had done things even with DNA chips and so on. So he did this for a thesis, and when he finished, he got a postdoc up here at LBL for a couple of years, and then where he continued in this sort of thing, and he's becoming an expert in aerosols and mass spectroscopy, this kind of thing, and then he went to JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and he's been involved with mass spectroscopy and design of things for these Mars missions, you know, dust and things like that, adherence of dust and so on. So he's doing that, and I know one thing, he made a comment, he found different in that LBL seems to be basically more run by, in the past it always was, by physicists, whereas JPL is run by engineers, and it makes a different environment that you basically are in as a difference. And JPL, as you know, is run by
Caltech.
And my friend Tom Everhart, who used to be the president there, I learned a little bit about how you know, the Caltech oversight is probably no different than the UC oversight of LBL and so on. So Steve is there, and neither he nor Sarah have gotten married, so that's why we've got one grandchild. I assume if Steve someday settles down that age won't catch him, but our daughter Sarah is now 41, and so that is by definition limits her on that. But our three children get along very well, and we have a place we bought in 1965 up at a cabin at Pinecrest, which is on Sonora Pass, about 30 miles above Sonora. Camp Blue, Camp Gold, which are the Cal alumni camps, are right there. Have you been to Pinecrest there? Beautiful place.
No, it must be not.
Right a couple of miles up is a ski region called Dodge Ridge, which that's right there. Elevation 5,600 feet, so just lovely climate. All in the winter, sometimes it may be 6 feet of snow. But we've gone there all the time, and I work all the time, or used to, and I considered Pinecrest being really great because even though I might take, blow my wife's mind that I'd take not one but two briefcases, but I played with my kids there, because Steve was only two when we bought the place, and so, you know, played games with them and so on, which if I were here in Berkeley, I probably wouldn't have done. And
that's
so it really was a big thing, and Steve was always really out looking for things and doing things, and he told Peg one time, he said, you know, I can just smell the different seasons up here. That's only a little. And he'd catch tree frogs and stuff.
That's wonderful to have that.
Oh, it really was. And early on, my wife would say, I know why we come up here. All you do is work. And I'm now speaking not that work, but I would be, you know, when you got heavy snow like that, there's a lot of damage and things, and, you know, I would be shingling or do this and that. Well, you know, I could physically be up there pounding nails and cursing the dean. that is true.
Good therapy.
And good therapy. Whereas if I go down and lie on the beach, well, then my stomach kind of turns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas she'd rather lie on the beach. And we was fish a lot, and uh-huh. and I don't know whether she likes it or not, but we fish in a boat and troll.
Uh-huh.
That usually goes with me on that, and my son Steve's a very ardent fly fisher, but I'm too intense to enjoy. I just can't just gently do the fly fishing. But we still, you know, for here, what's that, 35 years, 36 years we've had that, and go there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't think I've hardly ever been there more than a week at a time in the summer. Is that the dumbest thing?
Well,
I ever heard of, you know.
But you go out for a short period.
Through the years, every 3 weeks roughly, we'd be up for the weekend. And
your children still go too?
Oh yeah, and you know, that is very calming, you mm-hmm. know, because the kind of life I've led, always the tension builds up, and I mm-hmm. could go up there and knock it down, and mm-hmm. and. So that's summer and winter, we would be every roughly, well, in summer would be there a lot more than that, but every 3-4 weeks maybe be there. We would spend Thanksgiving here, but go up Friday and, you know, be there. And then usually right after Christmas for a week or 10 days, we always went up.
Are you skiers?
I quit downhill a long time ago, but I started too old in life. Mm-hmm. Like one year I never fell down. If you don't fall down, that means you're too cautious. But the last time I went downhill skiing, my son was there, Steve. He's only 12, I think. And I fell down and he stopped to see me, and I said, I'm getting up, no problem. And a second or two later, I heard somebody crying. He'd gotten only about 30 feet away and turned and had a spiral break on his leg and broke his leg. And the doctor said if he'd been even 6 months older, he'd have been 6 months in a cast. Mm. And Steve now just, he's a fearless skier. He'll go out with mountain cross-country skis. That means cross-country that can act as downhill skis like a fool. And mm-hmm. he'll go out, take a tent, you know, these mountain tents and go skiing mm-hmm. all day and stay out. I can't believe it. So we were, you know, reverted to cross-country skiing.
Yeah.
I haven't done it now a couple of years, but and Peg with her hip probably will never go again, mm-hmm. probably. But we could, the little forest road, see, mm-hmm. are snow-covered, so they make nice places mm-hmm. for cross-country.
So that was a nice
But that place has been a big, big plus to our, mm-hmm. our life, and our kids get there a lot. I think Sarah enjoys it the most, but you know, they're down there in Long Beach, and Steve's down in Pasadena, so it's a, you know, it's a long drive up for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to plan it on the longer time, and Lucy. We'll spend a week or something there with the kids. They get
mm-hmm.
we've had Thanksgiving there twice, the whole all everybody last 2 years.
That's
and
nice.
But you know, these are it's just a great plus.
Mm.
I'm just a lot, you know, maybe some people think one does nothing but work, but I just like to, you know, photography, I've spent, I've got thousands of slides. I've seen the world through a camera, and I don't know what's going to happen to them, but you maybe know that. You know people like that.
That's a problem, what to do with all those slides.
Yeah, isn't that right? And you know, I've got more Nikon. I could set up a store in Nikon equipment, and
mm-hmm.
and I decided to quit it, and then I went to a little point-and-shoot, and then I started getting prints, and now I just bought a new toy, which is a digital camera,
oh, yeah. mm-hmm.
which but you know, do that. I also started a hobby a few years ago of collecting mining lamps and oil lamps and candlesticks, of which even my wife says, well, maybe we better go in this antique store now. And I have old oil lamps and things, 100, 200 years old from Europe, lots of candlesticks, old carbide lamps. Carbide came into existence at the turn of the century, and I've seen something from an old report of Homestake that one year, 1890s, 42 million candles were bought for use in the mine.
Oh.
You know, when they had this, were using candlesticks. Mm-hmm. I've got one, I think, Homestake, one or two Homestake candlesticks. I have a nephew who was a miner there at Homestake, and he said one time, and then he got into the mechanical part, and he said it came on a box of about three wooden boxes full of candlesticks.
Yeah.
And they all disappeared somewhere, and I sure would like to have got my hands on something. That he had no interest in them, but that was the lighting. I must have 150 of these. I don't know what's going to happen.
Really?
I got all kinds of them from all over the world, of oil lamps. And
what about your cartooning? Have you done any of that lately?
Oh, just in birthday cards. But my old lecture notes are full of cartoons, and it depended on the lecture. If the lecture was very good, there's not much there. But if it was a little bit dull, it's all full of...
You have a lot of talent.
All full of cartoons, I'll tell you. plus we... You know, there's another great thing of living here in the Bay Area and I don't know how many people, I don't think very many of my colleagues take advantage of it to the extent that we do, which is music and plays. You know, we've got, for years, have had season tickets to Berkeley Repertory Theater, which has really grown to be very good, as you know. And there's a little theater called the Aurora Theater, which, by the way, they're moving this week into their new building, apparently.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, go to their series. You know, we're talking about a half a dozen or in each series or more, plus minus. And then we have go to San Francisco Symphony on a short series, not a weekly one. But we do go to the opera, and we've done that for many years. And I like, you know, it's most of the time beautiful music done by beautiful singers, and that's a regular thing. Mm-hmm. And you can see that. In the fall, when the opera season is, it can get pretty.
It takes a lot of time.
It can, all of a sudden I say, what? We got another one to go to or something? And I'll tell you, this past Wednesday, we went to Die Meistersinger.
Mm.
We left here at 4 o'clock, had dinner, a light dinner. In San Francisco, the opera started at 6:30 and was, and Meistersinger is long, 5 hours. It was over at about 25 minutes to midnight, and we got home at about 8:45.
Oh,
that's that music was beautiful, and before we went, I said, you know, awesome, it's going to be 5 hours, and.
It's worth it.
And so that's always a...
Yeah, I know you love opera.
So we have all these different kinds of... Plus, I got two almost complete woodworking shops. One that here in Berkeley, and you need it up in the mountains to take care of things. So practically any tool there is, I got, or more than one of them, and I can, you know, do the carpentering, and I do some of the plumbing, because once in a while you get freezing problems, and it can't do anything major, but I even do the rewiring at times, and so I play electrician a bit, and it's just a lot of, I'm seeing wiring out here, but in the mountains, and we do all of that.
Well,
you have to say some words, right?
Right, we're about ready to
finish up here.
Well, yeah, I'm just wondering when you look back on it in general, I remember from your retirement dinner how impressed I was that you said that you had made good decisions and that you had followed the path that you had wanted to follow, which I thought was wonderful. But I was wonder if there are things now that you wish you had made a different decision or done it a different way.
Well, my only disappointment is really the direction that I see this department going. Maybe those change of directions are all over because of the change in industry. I think that changes take place in all sorts of every field probably. And
you built the department up from practically nothing to a worldwide
department. At least in my processing area is true, probably my one disappointment is the second person that was on faculty here in the mineral processing area. Cal Sastry has never developed as a active ongoing faculty member. I always consider him probably the most intelligent person here, but obviously it takes more than intelligence to be able to function and lead a program. Because in the last years we've had, you know, roughly a group of four people that have been in the overall processing side. Jim Evans in the sort of the pyrometallurgy, high temperature metallurgy. Fiona Doyle, who is a Donald McLaughlin professor of mineral engineering, who's basically been in the area of hydrometallurgy. And then Cal Sastry, who is in the mineral processing area, mostly involved with process modeling and computer simulations, this sort of thing, plus myself, who has covered quite a number of the areas. But Sastry is just not developed any program whatsoever. He's had, maybe some years ago, the last person finished a PhD with him, and a handful have done master's degrees. And as a result of that, this whole area is going to die out with his retirement, and because of his not having an active program, there's no way you can justify a replacement for me. That's exactly what the situation. See, I mean, because the place runs on Bean County, right? And in contrast, even in these days, there are, you know, very ongoing programs at like at Columbia, Soma Sundra, and my former student has built up a good program within a not very active situation at Columbia. Jan Miller at University of Utah has a very strong program, which is a continuation of what my brother really had got started there, and another former student of mine, John Herbst, who was there one time. Bridge Modegill at Florida has this huge NSF center on particulates, and somebody named Kumar Kawatra, K-A-W-A-T-R-A, who's an Indian from at Michigan Tech, has a very ongoing program, but here, unfortunately, is very little. I continue to have one or two students, and I don't know how many years I will. That takes energy to do that. But then I think things will die, and what's going to happen is everything going more towards electronic materials and this sort of thing. And
is there no other institution in the state that has any comparable thing?
None. You know what? 25 years ago, 30, 25 years ago or so, Stanford had cut out their program. And in fact, a very able person was Bob Bartlett in the extractive metallurgy area. Super able, and he was associate professor. But they made the decision not to give him tenure because they were going to phase it out. If somebody senior one, when he died, they would, or retired, they would phase it out. And another able person in my general area, George Parks, moved on into environmental, did the same thing in the environmental area. So the answer to that is there's very little. Yet California is, production-wise, I think the biggest producer of minerals in the country to this day yet, in the value of its minerals.
Mm-hmm.
It
of course, Maury in
Nevada. Well, my brother in Nevada, Maury, is a good person, does excellent work, very, very good, very dynamic. Unfortunately, he got the name first, and now he's the younger brother. And I think it's always that younger brother syndrome, right?
I don't know.
Well, I think so. But I'm very pleased with his abilities and what he's accomplished. Anyway. Some years ago, I think it was on the telephone, that I had a conversation with Matt Arbiter, Professor Arbiter, who was born 1911. I just happened to know that, which means he's 90 today. And when you talk to him, he's still got that same old enthusiasm.
That's wonderful.
I remember him saying, two, 3 years ago, saying something to the fact that I think we have lived through the heyday of our field, and which really means the 20th century, because that's where all the real developments took place, and his role in it. Active role probably was started in 1930 when he worked with Taggart. Let's say roughly 1930 or so, to probably approaching 1980, because he still active as a consultant then, and so on. So he covered a long part of it, and my activities were really intense with, you know, the last half century, you know. I started as a grad student of MIT, 1950, actually. Butte was 1949, and lived and was actually part of, I think, bringing this field, the understanding of it, to a good status, both bringing, had a lot to do with bringing physical chemistry into the study of flotation, understanding of flotation, predicting, you know, how it behaves. A lot of that, you know, my role was very major in that, and been really a big part of simulation and understanding comminution phenomena, grinding. I started that because it was easy to do, and so I always kept one foot in the door on that, and followed that right on through, and still have a bit going on. As I said, I don't know how long. But anyway, you know, one final sentence is, I think everybody ought to take a look. Is the world better off that you pass through it? Mm-hmm. I think it is.
You've certainly left a lot better. A lot better. You said Godin did the first half of the century.
You're right.
You did the second half. An arbiter, I guess, bridged a little
bit. Oh, he was, but, yeah.
But the first half was Godin.
Oh, he brought, you know, stuff he did in the early 20s, mm-hmm. and then the heyday was middle 20s, that before, and then he went to Butte in 1929, so, that everything he did in the 20s, 30s, and of course 40s, 50s until his retirement, was, I'm always amazed how good it is, mm-hmm. when you read back, and you know the thought process that's important, that was there. To me, amazes me to go back and read some of the ideas that he had, or Wark had, Ian Wark, or Taggart. If those people were quite phenomenal at it.
Well, people be saying the same about you. You know. But I think, though, perhaps probably a lot of people have said, well, we've seen the greatest period. Don't you imagine that might be sort of a universal sense that...
Hey,
and then somebody else comes along with, you know, new materials and new...
Hey, isn't that, you know, that is really right. You know, there's something like around the turn of the century, I think the head of the patent office said that everything worth patenting has been invented. And I think somebody, major person in physics, I have those quotes somewhere, some major person in physics around somewhere in the 1900s, said, I think all the major physics has been done, but I can see how something that a field you think everything's known about, even in well, let's say, contact angles, which is when you have a bubble and you put it on a hydrophobic mineral particle, you can see, or you see a wax car with a drop of water, that angle. Well, Wark really did a tremendous amount of work with the contact angles, thought that was all it was. And somebody, I know he was at DuPont, named Johnson, wrote a lot of papers on contact angles in the all around late 50s, early 60s. And I thought, well, that was the last word in contact angles. And then a very outstanding person who was I think his background was physics in Germany, but he was at Buffalo and then in University of maybe McGill or Toronto, named Neumann, and he did a whole new series of papers on contact angles and wetting. And now, something that I thought had all been solved and was so simple, kept moving along. And so I think that's true in many fields. So and surely our field not going to disappear.
No.
Because resources are going to be needed, and the something I've been preparing a little stuff for Sweden, and because I've got to give a talk there, and I wanted to do it in generalities. But you know, the U.S. had 5% of the world's people in the 20th century and used up 30% of the resources. Now you take, what if you take these other countries in China, India in particular, with their masses of people, bring them up even part way to our use, and now you see what problems face the world on raw materials, and of course on energy and
processing is going to be
there,
more important.
And the mining and total utilization, if you can have that, of the resources, right? It's going to come back to that. In fact, I read the NEE magazine, the latest issue, when I was in Washington, and they're now starting to talk about uranium again as energy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the sources that somebody's proposing, and I'm speaking of by John Holdren, who used to be, is getting uranium from seawater.
Mm.
Now you can imagine, and what's going to be a whole new, that's a processing thing.
Sure.
And so on. It,
they'll have to go to
see, and
like
so this
it.
Is going
to
be, in fact, all these problems of environment, energy source, and so on, got to be solved by engineers.
That's
right. So we'll get back to that.
Okay.